Hi, everybody. You've waited. You've told me you were excited. And finally, it's lit time with Dr. Tess. Hey, I'm glad you're here listening to our first episode ever of this podcast. As you can tell by my title, we're going to talk a lot about literature, but I'm going to take a really broad definition of literature. And I wanted to get into that broad definition today by just talking about what is a story. So if you saw my Facebook post, you saw that I made a reference to Forky from Toy Story 4, and I don't know if you've ever seen those little videos that Disney Plus came out with where Forky is asking questions. In fact, the series is called Forky Ask a Question. So I just want you to imagine him asking, what is a story? And I'm going to hopefully give you a more satisfactory answer today than some of his toy friends gave him to the answers to some of the really existential philosophical questions that he has asked on that series. That was especially a shout out to my dad, Todd Stockslager, who loves Forky. All right, so today we are going to talk about what a story is. And I want to give you a couple of definitions that have been given by famous and knowledgeable people over the years, and then I'm going to give you kind of an alternate way of looking at it. And you might think, like, why do we even need to do an episode about this? I mean, everybody knows what a story is, right? But if you try to define story, I think a lot of people are going to come up short. I know that I would have trouble coming up with just kind of a quick definition of it. I think a lot of people would say, well, a story is something you tell, which actually is probably not that far off. And I'm going to circle back around to that at the end of this episode. It is something you tell. I think there is more profundity in that than you might immediately think. But I'm going to give you a couple of different definitions. And one thing I want to be really clear about, even though I'm a literature professor, I have degrees in literature, this is not going to be primarily a literary criticism podcast. And I mean two things by that. One is that we're not going to get into, like, you know, a lot of literary critical theories, although I am going to bring up my favorite literary critic today. I do have a favorite literary critic. But the concept that I'm going to bring up from her is pretty simple and easy to understand, so don't worry. The other thing I'm saying about this is that, using critical in another sense, this is not going to be a podcast about, like, what's crappy about literature, and it's not going to be me, like, you know, being, you know, snobby and highbrow and all that kind of stuff. But I do want to give us all some concepts that we can use when we talk about stories. If you've ever had a great conversation with someone about a movie that you just saw, or a book that you just read, or a video game that you just played, or a board game that you just played, or a comic book that you just read, or anything, I want to give you some terms and some constructs that you can use in those conversations to make them even better and more fun than they already are, hopefully. So that's what this podcast is going to be about. At the end of the episode, I'll talk a little bit more about what my plans are going forward. But for now, thank you for being here. Let's talk about what is a story. All right, so I'm going to start out with some definitions that have been given. And some of these you've probably heard before. You might have heard people talk about these, like, in, you know, a literature class in high school or college. If you're a writer, I know some of the people who have already expressed interest in this podcast, you yourself are a writer. You might have heard these given in the form of advice for writers, like, your story has to have this or it's not going to get published. And I do want a little side note on that. This is not primarily a podcast for writers, but I'm hoping that writers can find a lot to use. But context is so important. So the concepts that I'm going to give you guys today are pretty general. And if you are a writer, hopefully you can use some of this. But I'm not going to give you hard and fast rules. Like, if I were an editor and I said to you, or like a publisher, and I said, you know, your story is never going to get published if it doesn't have X, Y, and Z, like, that's totally appropriate for that context, because that editor is probably right about that. Sometimes, you know, we all have heard the famous stories about, you know, the publishers that rejected J.K. Rowling and stuff like that. Sometimes they're wrong. But context is really important here. So I'm going to try to, throughout the course of our discussion here today, give you a definition of story that works across contexts. Isn't limited to a specific context. Okay. This is getting this introduction is getting really long. I always had that problem of having really long introductions. All right, here we go. Here are some definitions of stories that have been given over the years. First of all, Aristotle, in his famous work Poetics, said that a story has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Well, duh. But think about it for a second. Do you know any stories that start like in the middle of an action scene? That's a pretty common thing to do in like superhero movies these days. The technical term for that is in media res, which means like in the middle. That's my paraphrase of what that means. It means like while stuff is already happening. And actually, that can be a really great way to get to know the characters by throwing them immediately into a high pressure situation. So that story, does it have a beginning? I don't know. You could argue that it starts in the middle. A lot of stories have flashbacks. A lot of stories have what we call frame narratives, where, like, you might have had to read Heart of Darkness in school. You've got a guy who is on a boat with some passengers, and then he decides to go back and tell his story that happened in Africa. And so that's a frame narrative, and most of the story takes place in the past. So there's a lot of things that authors and storytellers more broadly can do with beginning, middle, and end. So, and you know, some stories like don't have an ending either because they might end on a cliffhanger. You could argue that that cliffhanger is the ending. I don't know. I think that's semantics. So beginning, middle, and end, it's a little bit it's a little bit gray. It's a gray area. All right, let's talk about another one. Something that I used to tell my students in classroom a lot is that a story has to have a conflict or a problem. After a while, I started revising that idea to problem when I would talk to my students about it, because I used to teach children's literature. And if you think about like some really, really simple like early reader books for children, they might not have a conflict in the sense of like two characters fighting or one character fighting against his own psyche or, you know, character fighting against society, you know, those famous conflicts that you might remember from school. Like little children's books, a lot of times don't have those, but they might, though, still have, and they usually do, still have a problem. So I always used to give the example, and I think there actually is a book that has this plot that I'm about to say, but I don't know the title, so if you know it, give it a shout out. Like where the problem is, I lost my hat, and like that's the entire plot. Where is my hat? That's the problem. That's the conflict. It's simple, but it works. But recently, I've started thinking about, does the story even have to have that? And the reason why I started thinking about it is because a student of mine said, and I now teach online, and I teach upper level writing students, and many of them are creative writing students, so they're writing pieces of fiction, for example, for my class. And I had a student this past set of courses say that they wanted to write a story that takes place in heaven. And if we believe that heaven is, and I'm coming at this from a Christian perspective, if we believe that heaven is a place where there's no sin, then can there be conflict? And if there's no conflict, can you have a story? And I really thought about that a lot. And actually, my student ended up taking the project in a different direction, which was fine. But we talked about that and thought, like, could that be a story if there's no conflict? Now, a lot of theologians would say, well, there's not going to be conflict in heaven, but we might still be problem solving because we're going to be learning. And so, okay, that maybe could create a story. But I don't know. That's I want to like put a pin in that one and maybe come back to it later, because I there's a, you know, there's a possible example of a story that doesn't have any conflicts and maybe doesn't even have any problems in it. Okay, so what have we talked about so far? Beginning, middle, and end. Does the story have to have them? Maybe. Conflict or problem, does the story have to have that? Maybe. All right, let's talk about another one. A lot of people would say that in order for a story to be a story, the main character has to go through some sort of change. We could do a different episode on types of characters, but you might have heard the term dynamic character before versus a static character. Static character would be a character that never changes, that stays the same. Dynamic character would be a character who goes through some sort of change. Usually we talk about that being a positive change, but it could be like the character gets worse. I mean, that happens sometimes. But so does the story have to have that? And I often used to tell my students, typically we expect the main character of a story to be a dynamic character. The side characters, they don't have to necessarily go through a change. Sometimes they do. But usually in a good story, I would tell my students, we expect the main character to be dynamic and to go through a change. But is that always true? I recently read a book that has really got me thinking about really all of these different definitions of story and wondering, like, about their about whether they're universally applicable, let's put it that way. And the book that I read was One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Okay. Most of you have probably heard of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Maybe not. I shouldn't assume that. If you've never heard of him, I will spell his name for you when I post this, so that you can look him up because it's not necessarily spelled the way that it sounds. And by the way, I realize that Ivan is an American pronunciation. I don't know how Russians would really pronounce that name. We're going to call him Ivan. Okay, so Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the author, was a guy who was a Soviet prisoner for a number of years, and he wrote this book. It's a pretty short book, and it is about one day in the life of this man who's also a Soviet prisoner in a work camp that had been there for quite a number of years. And this book, like, the character doesn't change. Ivan is the same man at the end of the story as he was at the beginning. It is not like a defining day in his life where everything changes. There are little mini conflicts and problems throughout the story. Actually, they're pretty big. We would look at them and say, well, they're pretty big. But for him, they're kind of just like, another day. This is what I deal with every day. And by the way, sidebar here, we would call that an episodic story, a story that's made up of a whole series of little conflicts and problems. Most stories have more than one, but if it's a story that doesn't, well, I was about to say story arc. We'll get to story arc in a second, but episodic. So just think of it like TV episodes. Some TV shows, like my husband and I are watching Stranger Things, that one kind of has like one plot that goes through the entire season. But most TV series that you could name have each little episode has its own story that is wrapped up by the end of the series. That's starting to change as their different I don't know, HBO and Netflix and AMC series and stuff like that become more prominent and popular. They're not, they're less likely to be episodic. But anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. You'll hear this a lot, me going off on a tangent. Okay, let's go back to Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Ivan Denisovich, this character, he doesn't change throughout the course of the story. He doesn't have one big, huge conflict. And when he goes to bed at the end of the day, nothing has changed for him. He's no closer to getting out of prison. He hasn't really learned any lessons. He hasn't, like he hasn't changed at all. His circumstances have not changed and he has not changed as a person. And yet, it's a great book. It's a fascinating book. But could someone look at that and say, well, that's not a story. That's just a slice of life. Maybe. I think we're getting kind of pedantic there. But yeah, maybe you could look at that and say, like, that's not a story because the character doesn't change at all. I don't know if I personally would say that. But anyway, that's an example. By the way, very good book. Doesn't take long to read. It's got some dark humor in it. Really interesting slice of life of the Soviet prison camps. And it actually this is kind of, this isn't really a spoiler. At the end of the book, he ends up saying, like, "Wow, this was a really good day." And we, the readers, there's a lot of irony there because we're thinking, really, it's a good day. You're in a prison camp and you were like eating gruel for all of your meals. But he, he goes through and points out what went well for him that day, and he's like, out of all the days that I've spent in this prison camp, this is like in the top 10 or whatever. So, anyway, that's an example of a story where the main character doesn't change. There's multiple conflicts, but one not one big main conflict. And yeah, I guess you could say it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and an end because it takes place over the course of one day. But anyway, all right. So the biggest definition that you will hear—I'm sorry—the most, I should say, the most common or the most well-known definition you will hear people give of a story is that a story has to have a story arc, ARC. You hear that term a lot if you're a writer or if you are anybody who's interested in story structure. If you are are a person who runs role-playing games. My husband does that, and he has taught me that there are a lot of similarities between doing that and writing a book, for example. If you are one of those people, you have probably heard of a story arc before. And that's just this basic structure that most stories, again, I'm saying most, not all, will have. I'm not going to go through all the parts of this. You've probably heard them before. It starts with like a exposition, and that's where you get to know the characters and the setting and all that kind of stuff. And then it goes into a rising action, and then, you've seen these are kind of they're usually written out. This is why I should be doing a YouTube video, not a podcast, so you can see the story arc. But seriously, just Google story arc, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's like a triangle that's kind of leaning over to one side. I'm sure there's a math term for that. Because the high point, the pinnacle, is what we usually call the climax. And the climax of a story usually, as a general rule, takes place somewhere from like two-thirds to three-fourths of the way from the end of the story. And the climax is a moment of decision, typically. It's a moment where the main character has to decide, if they're well, actually, let me rephrase that. It's either a decision or it's a confrontation of some sort. So if it's in a kind of a traditional story structure where you've got like a good guy and a bad guy, the climax will be where the good guy and the bad guy confront one another and have a battle between good and evil. But sometimes in a main or sometimes in a more of like a psychological type story, the climax is where the main character decides like I got to change my life, or they make a very difficult decision or something. The climax is the emotional and it's the emotional high point of the story, and it's also the point in the story where the story could go two different ways. If the good guy wins, take a left. If the bad guy wins, take a right. Or, if he makes this decision, or if he makes this decision, you know what I'm saying? All right. So usually we expect the climax of a story to be, like I said, about two-thirds to three-fourths of the way through the story. And I might, I could see an editor saying to someone, well, like, if your story has it doesn't have a climax, or if the climax is too early, or if the climax is too late, or whatever, nobody's going to read this book. I don't think that's necessarily true either. And I can think of examples where the climax, or what seems to be the climactic moment, could be at a different spot. So my husband was just reading a book, and actually I should have asked him this before I recorded this podcast to get an update from him. But he's giving me a thumbs up. He's giving me a two. What's the two mean? I have a live studio audience, guys. There was a second climax. Okay, good. So I'm going to give this example. So my husband was reading this book, which I highly recommend. Some of you might have read it before if you were ever in my book club and you're listening to this, or our book club. You may have read the Winter Night Trilogy by Katherine Arden. I highly recommend the Winter Night Trilogy. It's fantasy, but it's fantasy that is deeply rooted in the real world. It takes place in medieval Russia, and it is based very heavily on Russian folklore. And so I like that groundedness of it. It didn't feel like what I typically think of as fantasy. So it's a trilogy, and the last book is called, what is the last book called? The Winter of the Witch. The last book is called The Winter of the Witch. The first one is called The Bear and the Nightingale, and that one kind of stands on its own if you just wanted to read that one, but I don't think you could stop yourself after that one. You would want to go on and read the whole trilogy. Anyway, so last book, Winter of the Witch. All right. So I remember this being the case when I read the book probably about a year ago, and my husband just read it like over the past few days, and he said he got like, I don't know, what'd you say, like a quarter of the way into it, and he felt, no, half. Halfway into it, and he felt like, oh, the climax of this story has already happened. The thing that I thought was going to be the big event of the entire series has already happened. That's weird. And I see that there's still like half of this book left. What's going on? And so of course he kept reading, and he found out there was actually another climax. Would you say a bigger climax second time around, or about the same size? Bigger? Second one was bigger. All right. So it turned out that book actually did have a typical story structure, but that the writer kind of faked us out by having an early climax. And what she was really doing there was showing that what happened the second time was maybe even more important than what we thought was so important. So there's an example of a writer kind of playing with their expectations of story structure. I am going to give an example toward the end of this episode of a movie that you may have heard of called Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And I'm going to talk about a scene from that movie that happens pretty early in the movie. I'll go ahead and talk about it now, but I'll come back to that scene later. In Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which if you've never seen this movie, what are you doing? It's been out for like 35 years, and it's an excellent comedy by John Hughes, starring Steve Martin and John Candy. This got some of the greatest comedic performances of all time, but it also has heart. It's not just like a purely goofy comedy. It's a wonderful movie to watch with your family on Thanksgiving, except that it's got a scene that your parents will have to fast forward because it has the F word in it. My parents always fast forward it for when we were kids. Okay, that's neither here nor there. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is you could call it a buddy comedy, and it's got this scene fairly early in the movie. I don't know the timestamp, but like well before the halfway point, where the two main characters have this confrontation. And if you've seen the movie, I'm talking about the part where Steve Martin kind of like, where Neil Page, his character name, really goes off on John Candy's character about him being annoying, and you know, talks about him being a chatty Cathy doll and all that kind of stuff. I truly have a point to that scene, and I'm going to come back to it later. But my point here is that, like, to me, whenever I watch that, I'm always like, that feels like it should be later in the movie. But I actually think it makes a lot of sense that it's early in the movie, because after that point, I think they're allies. They were enemies. Now they're allies. They might still get irritated at each other sometime, but they've been through this like difficult moment of anger and reconciliation. And then it becomes them against fate and the world rather than them against each other. So that's just my little theory on that. But every time I watch that, I'm like, wow, this feels like a climax. Because I think in a lot of comedies, that would be the climax. The climax of this movie is actually something even higher and more beautiful. And it's really got kind of a twist ending, but it's got one of the most perfect twist endings ever. So, all right, I'm digressing. Let's circle back here. All right, so I've given you a couple of definitions of a story that are often true, but are not always true. So let's review those for a minute here. It has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has to have a conflict or problem. The main character has to go through a change. And there has to be a story arc with a climax about 2/3 to 3/4 of the way through the story. Again, often true, not always true. Okay, I'm going to give you an alternative view of what a story might be, and this is where I'm going to bring in a little bit of literary criticism. I'm going to bring in my favorite literary critic, Louise Rosenblatt. I have a book, so if you're interested in this stuff at all, what I'm about to say, I highly recommend the highly readable the book called The Reader, the Text, and the Poem by Louise Rosenblatt. Just if I could go on a little rant here about Louise Rosenblatt. When I was taking literary criticism classes, I had one at the undergrad level, one at the master's level, one at the PhD level, and I'm going to tell you a secret here, I never really enjoyed my literary criticism classes because they were very theoretical, and I don't necessarily think of myself as an abstract thinker. I like examples, as you can probably already tell. I like concrete examples, and so those classes were always kind of a drag to me, but one of several bright spots was Louise Rosenblatt, who often gets kind of forgotten. She isn't always named among the famous or important, quote-unquote, important reader response theorists, even though I would put her in reader response theory, because people thought, well, she's more of an educator than a literary theorist, whatever. I think it was because she was a woman, but that's a different story for a different day. Anyway, her book, The Reader, The Text and the Poem, very readable, very understandable. She talks about different kinds of reading. I'm not going to go into all that. I'm going to go into her concept of what it takes to make a poem. Now, she uses the word poem, which is a little bit confusing, but when she talks about a poem, she is talking about basically an event that occurs when you have a text of writing and a reader who brings it to life. Now, Louise Rosenblatt doesn't talk about the third element. Imagine a triangle. Again, this is the second time in this episode I've asked you to imagine a triangle. Imagine a triangle with, and the 3 points, the order of the 3 points doesn't really matter, okay, because they're all equally important. You've got an author, you've got a text, and you've got a reader. If you ever took a communications class and you learned about like the rhetorical triangle, this is just a slight variation on the rhetorical triangle, which is like message sender receiver. So you've got an author. Now, Louisa Rosenblatt actually doesn't talk a lot about the author in her book. And my theory is that that's because at the time she was writing, I think people kind of took for granted the importance of the author, because that was before the mid-20th century when the death of the author theory happened. Don't worry about that right now if you have no idea what I just said. If you've ever taken a literary criticism class, you'll recognize what I mean by the death of the author. But basically, at Rosenblatt's time, everybody assumed, well, duh, a piece of writing has to have an author, and the author is important, and we should care about what the author says. In fact, I think at the time that she was writing this book, the author was often given too much importance. So she was working to remind people of the importance of the reader as well. So you've got an author, you've got a text, that maybe goes without saying, and then you've got a reader. And the reader was the element that a lot of literary critics prior to Louise Rosenblatt were forgetting about. I like to think of it this way. You know, if a piece of writing falls in the woods and there's no one around to hear it, then did it really fall? Louise Rosenblatt would say, no, there has to be a reader, or else these are just dead words on a page. The text is just a text without a reader. But when you bring together the reader and the text, and I would add the author, then you have this almost like alchemical reaction that happens that she calls a poem. But when we talk about a poem here, we're not just talking about, like, you know, rhyming words and meter and all that kind of stuff. We're talking about, like I said, an event of understanding, of a meeting of minds almost. Even if the writer is dead, even if the writer has been dead for hundreds of years, when this reaction happens, the reader and the writer are like meeting. And there's a whole school of literary criticism that talks about that. It's called phenomenology. But reader response theory gets into a little bit of it as well. If you're interested, like, send me a message and I can send you some more resources. But really all you need to understand is that you've got to have all three of those elements. So let me circle back to my opening definition that I said a lot of people would probably give for a story. A lot of people would probably say, well, I don't know, a story is something you tell. Yeah, that's right. A story is something that you, the author, tell, but I would add an extra element there. There's got to be a listener. I realize now, again, I'm not making a blanket statement here. I know that there are times when you might, you know, write in a private diary, and then you yourself would be the only reader. But still, you're the reader. You're reading that. Even if you never come back and read it again, you are both the author and the audience, the sender and the receiver in that case. A story is something that you tell. And let me come back to Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in closing here. I'm wrapping up. All right. So my question is, all right, so if a story is something that has an author and a reader and content or a text, excuse me, are all stories worth telling? I ask this because, like I said back at the beginning, sometimes we can get really critical about stories. I teach writing. A lot of my students, like I said, are creative writing students, and they turn in creative writing projects. And sometimes I'm tempted to look at a student story and go, like, why? Like, why? Like, I don't actually say this, but sometimes in my head I'm like, you know, who's going to read this? Who is ever going to read this? But then I think to myself, like, maybe their family is going to read this. Maybe they are going to read it themselves and be really proud of it and happy with it. I am going to read it as their professor. And does that stuff matter? Yeah, it really does. And so going back to that Planes, Trains, and Automobiles example, this popped into my head when I was thinking about this podcast episode the other day, and I think it really captures it. And like, seriously, go watch the movie if you don't know what I'm talking about. But in that scene where Steve Martin's character is just like really chewing out John Candy's character for being annoying, one of the big things that he focuses on is that he talks so much. And he says, you know, he calls him a chatty Cathy doll. And he says something like, here's an idea. If you're going to tell a story, have a point. And that's the point. That's the part in the rant where you can tell like Del John Candy's character is getting like really hurt. You can see it on his face. And of course, like, Neil doesn't know when to stop. And I think about that idea that, like, why do we demand that stories have to have points? You know, sometimes we just tell a story just because we want to put out into the world, I saw this, I experienced this, this actually happened. And those kinds of stories can be really, really valuable. And yes, I'm calling them stories, even if they don't have a beginning, middle, and end, even if they don't have a climax and a denouement and all that kind of stuff. Those stories, I think, can be worth telling. In fact, in some contexts, we would actually call those kinds of stories evidence or witness bearing. Those kinds of stories are really, really important. And so I would say, all stories are worth telling. If there is a sender or a teller, if there is somebody who's willing to listen, then that's a story. And we shouldn't worry so much about whether it has all the correct elements to it. And so, again, I've been thinking about this a lot because of my teaching. I've also been thinking about it a lot because I got married a year ago. And when you're married, you share a lot of things. I'm looking at Jordan right now. Aww. You're with somebody all the time, and you find yourself talking about stuff that before you didn't have anybody to talk about with because nobody really wanted to listen. And so sometimes, like, I don't know, we'll wake up in the morning and I will remember something funny that Jordan said in his sleep overnight. I will not give you examples. And I'll tell him, oh, you did this cute thing, or you said this cute thing in your sleep. And I will tell it to him. And it may not have a plot or a beginning, a middle, and an end. But to me, that's a story worth sharing with Jordan. And he's smiling, so I hope he's thinking, yes, and it was a story worth listening to as well. So my point here is, hopefully, one, I gave you some context and some terms that you can use when you discuss stories with other people. And seriously, like, if you're interested at all in Louise Rosenblatt, look up her book, The Reader, The Text, and the Poem. I think it's fascinating. I also wrote a little bit about this in my doctoral dissertation, which was published under my maiden name, Tess Stockslager, and I'm totally tooting my own horn here, but I don't make any money off of my doctoral dissertation. But if you have access to the ProQuest Dissertations and Theses database, which you probably do if you have a university email address of any kind, look it up. It's about Harry Potter and Charles Dickens and also literary theory. If you're interested in reading it and you don't have a university email address, let me know and I can try to hook you up with a copy. But yeah, I get into a little bit into that and what it means for fan theory, actually, in my dissertation. So hopefully I gave you some vocabulary and some concepts that you can use. Listen, if you are an English major and you're sitting here going like, oh my gosh, she just oversimplified everything. Yes, I understand that I did. If you do feel like I said something inaccurate, please let me know. But intentionally, I did not. I wanted this to keep this under half an hour, and now I'm over half an hour. So there's that. But my other point that I was trying to make was, I think if you've got a story to tell, don't let anybody tell you not to tell it. Because I think stories are valuable, whether or not they fit that perfect story structure that we have been talking about and kind of dismantling throughout this episode. Okay. All right. So where do we go from here? I have some fun ideas for episodes, but I want to hear what you want to hear about as well. Do you have an idea for a literary podcast topic? But again, I'm using that broad definition of literature. It can be a movie. It can be a game, as long as it has a story. And yes, we're using that term very loosely now. then yeah, I will consider talking about it on here. I'm going to try not to focus on one specific literary text for an entire episode, so I'm probably not going to do reviews. But there are certain literary texts and worlds that maybe deserve a whole episode. Like I'm totally willing to do a Lord of the Rings episode or series, so I'll consider that. I have a couple people that are interested in being guests on my show, so get excited about that. You're going to get to hear some other voices besides mine. But thank you so much for listening and for your patience. And hey, if you've got most of you listening to this know me, or at least know me on Facebook. So if you've got questions, you got suggestions, send me a message, write me a comment, whatever. Thank you so much for listening. And lit time is never over, but this episode is over. So again, this is Dr. Tess, and I'm out.